Hey, everybody. My name is Jan Fuller, and I am an alcoholic. Amen. Hey, everybody. My sobriety date is October the 4th, 2004. And that was a rough day. I remember that day. The way I came in here was God has a sense of humor. I don't know if y'all know that or not, but he really has a sense of humor, at least my God does. And I'm a nurse, I'm a registered nurse, and I was a liver transplant coordinator. And I used to jokingly, with one of my other nurses, say, "You know, I wonder if I have cirrhosis, because I drink a lot." And seeing how these patients suffered, and I knew I didn't want to suffer like that. I did not want to suffer like that. But never thinking that I had a choice, never crossed my mind. And it wasn't enough to make me stop drinking, but I thought about it, and I was planning it, and I thought, man, that's going to be a miserable death. And I had just accepted that as my lot in life. I had no idea I had a choice. And it was during that period, while I was in that job, I'd been in it about, 6 years. And I remember myself saying to the doctors about patients who had come in for an evaluation, and they would have alcohol in their urine screen and in their blood. And I'd think, Oh, for heaven's sake, can you believe somebody would do that? And they're coming for an evaluation and they really want to get listed. How stupid is that? Wow, did I have a lot to learn. So when I did come in here, I realized that if they were one of us, they had lost the power of choice to drink. And that's it in a nutshell for me. My sponsor, she had 30 years this year, which is kind of seems like a popular amount of time to be sober around here. And she still goes to 3 or 4 meetings a week. She always chastises me because I don't go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. And I always tell her, I'll try to do better. And I really mean it when I say it, but she says, well, you're still working, she's retired. That's not a good enough excuse. But I'm willing today. I'm willing to take suggestions. I'm willing to listen to her. I'm willing to take what she says and know she's not saying it to be hurtful to me, because she's about this tall and she's a little powerhouse. And she looks like she'd be this sweet little grandmotherly type. Mm-mm. You never know what's going to come in a package. Because she calls me like she sees me. And that's exactly what I need. When I was young, I didn't know it then, but I know the name of it now. I was spiritually seeking. My mom and dad, I had an alcoholic father. Not every alcoholic does, and he was a mean drunk. He was physically abusive, he was verbally abusive, and I got the least of it. My mom got the most, my brother, and then me. And I was scared to death of that man, scared to death. So the last time that he called it a whipping. When it leaves bloody whelps on you, I don't call that a whipping. And my mom got home, and she said, "Stay here." And I heard things hitting the wall. I heard dishes being broken, and my brother was told to stay in his room. He's 3 years older than me, across the hall. And I got under my bed and fell asleep. And then she came in there at some point later and just boo-hooed when she saw I was under the bed and said, "He's gone now, he can't hurt you anymore." But then she just cried and cried and cried for days and weeks because he was gone. And I thought, well, that I was tickled to death. And I couldn't understand why she felt that way when she was the one who would get bruises and black eyes and all this stuff too. But he wasn't a part of our lives very much. We only went over to see him, my brother and I, when we had to, court ordered. And we didn't go very much, and he still drank, and he would just go off and go for a date and leave my brother and I at his house or apartment or wherever he lived, and he'd come home whenever he got ready. And, you know, we just learned that we'd rather him go than stay, quite frankly. But when we moved, my mom could barely support us, and then we had to move. We never lived in a house. We lived in an apartment. We moved in, had to move into the housing project in Mobile. And she was just, I am so sorry, I am so sorry. And I was like, I mean, you know, I don't care. I really didn't care. I had a couple of friends from elementary school that lived there, and we just got to be closer friends. But people did talk about you. You know, I noticed that they'd look at you funny or like, oh, you live in the project, you know. And already back then, I'm 64 and 11 and a half twelfths. Oh, well, I don't know. Math is not my forte. I'll be 65 in a week and a half. So that was a long time ago. But it was shameful to be the child of a divorced parent, at least where I came from. People looked down at you. People felt sorry for you. My mom did the best she could. I know she did the best she could. And we had everything we needed and most of what we wanted. I didn't know it at the time now. I didn't know it at the time. I was resentful when I didn't get everything I wanted. But she worked so hard. And so then my mom meets this man while we're still living there, and she gets married again. He is the sweetest man. Oh, my God. He was so sweet and kind, and he laughed a lot. But guess what? He liked to drink. He was an alcoholic. He drank until he got drunk, but he was a happy drunk. I wasn't used to that, you know. He would just laugh and just grin real goofily, and that was fine with me. You don't hit me. I like you. So they got married, and my mom, I think we may have gone to church some. Usually, I don't remember going to church, just real intermittently, because my dad certainly never did. But my brother and I, when we moved, when that stepfather, the first stepfather, when she married him, we moved into a house. And that was the first house I had lived in. And I was just all excited. And then there was a church at the end of the street from us, and my brother asked if my mom would drop us off at church on Sunday morning. And we were close enough, we usually walked back. Sometimes we walked too, because she drank a lot too. I don't know. I think she had all the symptoms of alcoholism, but she never declared herself so. So I don't know. But my stepfather definitely was. And, I mean, he was taking Anabuse, and I could hear him retching so often in the bathroom, and I think, what is wrong with him? He really wanted to quit drinking, but I guess he just didn't have a program. I don't know. But my brother and I would walk to church, and once I got to church, it was like, oh, I felt like I belonged. I was there for Sunday school. I was there for the, it was a real conservative Baptist church in Mobile, and I was there Sunday evening. We called it training union back then. I didn't know what that was, but I was there. My brother and I went Wednesday nights to have supper there and then stay for a service. I mean, you know, I loved it. I loved those people, and I thought they loved me, and I felt very welcome. And as a child, I had a religious spiritual experience while I was there and felt like I had God just come into me and lift all that up and say, you're okay, I'm going to take care of you. And I guess a lot of you know as Baptists have the altar call, and you know, and I swear I thought a light was shining, and this is the truth, I felt a light was shining on me, and I was pulled down that aisle, which seemed like it was like a football field long. And I remember just feeling so incredible. I was scared to death, but I was feeling so incredible. And I just had that spirit in me for such a long time. My mom still didn't come to church, but my brother and I went. And that church, that filled that hole a little bit, to the point where I felt like I just felt better. I felt lighter. Until, I guess, the summer after the eighth grade, my mom, we lived in Mobile. We came up every summer to stay with my grandparents up here for half the summer, and then my grandmother, my dad's mom, in Texas for the other half of the summer. And she called, and she said, I'm coming to get y'all tomorrow, bring you back home for her parents, and I have to tell you something. Your stepfather and I are getting a divorce. All I could see was red. How dare you? How dare you take the only man who's been a daddy to me away from me? I mean, it was all about me, of course. I found out later that's what big part of my problem was. It was all about me. And that is where my huge, huge resentment towards my mother started, I believe. I didn't realize it until I got sober and worked with a sponsor and all that, but I believe that's where that started. And so we came back. We moved to the other side of town where I didn't know a soul. I mean, I was going to be a cheerleader, for heaven's sake. You know, how could she? I had to start all over again. I was very shy. It was four times the size of my high school I was going to go to, and I was nothing and nobody. And I really resented her then. You know, I really resented her then. Actually, I knew one person, and he was from where I came. I didn't like him, though, so, you know, I didn't really foster that relationship. But, I mean, it was huge. My graduating class had 545 people in it. And I felt lost, you know, and I felt very shy. And I lost all that feeling I had. And at the same time that summer, I found out the minister of music, who I thought was literally, I had him way up here on a pedestal. That is the most saintly man I have ever known. And he has a wife who is an angel. And the pastor was a pulpit slapping, Bible thumping, spitting the gospel kind of preacher. Real flashy dresser too. I like that part. I found out he had been having affairs for many years. The minister of music also, which I thought, I mean, he kind of looked like Ernest Angley a little bit. Well, a lot. And I found out that he had done the same. And they told me I was going to go to hell because I was in the choir too. I came to choir practice one night in the ninth grade, and they said my dress was too short, and he had the pianist get a seam ripper that pulls stitches out, take the hem out of my dress. Now my grandmother had made it, and it probably, things were short back then. It probably came down to here. It was like, I don't know, 5 inches above my knee. Which that was way longer than most folks were wearing them. And she took that hem out, so I had that raw hem with strings hanging, and I didn't know anything else to do but go up there and sing. But then I found that other stuff out, and I said, to hell with y'all. I'm not coming back. You know, you lied to me. You lied to me. You expected me to do all this stuff, which I did, and you weren't doing it. So there came the beginning of my resentment towards organized religion. So in high school, I found out in the 10th grade, I discovered alcohol. And I found out that that could make you able to talk to anybody. I wasn't shy. I was anybody's friend. And the first time I drank, I got drunk and I blacked out. So, and I was going out with this older guy. We went to this dance thing. And I just thought that's what everybody did. Nobody told me that's not the way it was supposed to be. So, hey, and this was fun. All of a sudden, when I go back to school the next week, I have all these friends that I didn't have. And so kind of that's the way it started out, you know, just sporadically. Then I got in with a group of people in my junior year that one guy's parents was one of those families that didn't care at all if the kids drank at her house. They had a bar downstairs and a pool table and all that. So we would go over there on the weekend. I never had to buy anything. And we would get drunk. And I thought that was great. You know, and that continued until on into high school, and then it kind of delved into other things too. I just wanted to feel different. I wanted to feel accepted because at that point, I remember when I was a senior, well, you know, as well as I can remember because we have a disease of perception. So I have told myself I remember, but I do remember this particular incident, and that's looking in the mirror. And looking in the mirror in my bedroom and going, I hate you, with all the venom I could do. I hated myself that much. And, but, you know, the alcohol helped, I thought. So, you know, I go off to college, come up here to Birmingham to go to nursing school, and I get into, you know, I didn't hang around with people that didn't drink. You know, I didn't have anything to do with you if you didn't drink. And it just, so I kept all those people around me and drank and my mother insisted I go to Sanford for the first year, and then my hippie boyfriend and the band from Mobile moves to Birmingham. That was it. He moved in the summertime and I didn't study at all. And so I told my mom, I took two nursing courses I went August to August that last summer. And I told her I was going to quit because I wanted to live with him, and we were going to get engaged. I had just turned 19, and she was not happy about that. And, man, you know, boy, did things change. You know, I did live with them, and I got a cocktail job, and lo and behold, the legal age in Alabama went to 19, and I could be a cocktail waitress. Woo! I had never done that, but I figured I can do that, and it helped me out. I mean, it gave me a job, and I could contribute to my apartment and all that. But let me tell you what, I got in with a group of people, because I waited tables for quite a few years with people who partied. We had cash money at the end of the night. We went out every night after we worked, unless we were so hungover that we just had to hurry up and get home and get into bed. But we went out and we spent our money and we drank and we drank and we drank. And that is when, during that period of time, for probably about 4 or 5 years, I ended up in some situations that I don't know how I lived through it. I honestly don't know how I lived through it. I don't know everything that happened. I sort of figured it out, but it was never enough to make me stop drinking. I never thought I needed to stop drinking. I mean, even when I was with one of my nursing school buddies, drinking all day after finals, because, you know, why wouldn't somebody drink for 7 hours after they had finished finals? Going home and getting in her car and hitting a couple of police cars that were parked on either side of her and driving off laughing, and they didn't think it was funny because they were standing right there. And it was just like, you know, going. We didn't have far to go to SWAT all these police cars, and we were so drunk. And she hands me a bag and says, "Put these down your pants." Well, it's pills, some kind of capsules. And I was like, Okay. I mean, you know, and she did the same. And a female police officer yanked me out and said, give me the pills. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, she'd been standing right there. I mean, I was, you know, she saw me do it. And she just like, and reached down and pulled them out of the front of my pants. These. And I said, those are not mine. They are not. And she was like, yeah, right. But they weren't mine. I mean, why didn't she believe me? They weren't mine. Well, that was a very ugly situation because apparently this girl's girlfriend was dealing drugs. She was not in nursing school. She was older. And she had just had them in her car. I didn't know she had them in her car. And I didn't even know what they were at the time. But I ended up going to jail. Felony drug charge. Because they said, we're trying to break this ring at your college, and we're going to start with you. We're going to make an example out of you two. And you're never going to graduate nursing school. Matter of fact, you're going to go to jail, and you're not going to get out for a long time. Well, I believed him. Why wouldn't I believe him? As it turned out, we went to the city jail, and then because it was a felony, they transferred us to the county jail. And I had all these wonderful women that had been in the cell next to mine giving me tips on what to do once you got to county and what not to do and what to look out for. And I was thinking, how in the hell did I get into this? How did I get here? Hell, we were out celebrating finals just, you know, not even 12 hours ago. Well, what ended up happening, and I'm still not thinking I should stop drinking, by the way. Never crossed my mind. What ended up happening was it went to court, and she turned on me, and she said they were all my drugs. This is a good friend. Well, not after that. But as it turned out, and then it was just like something out of a cop show. And then, you know, she says, hey, you better get out of town because I'm just like, no, no, no. It was all her. And her friend said she was going to come and kill me. And she said, the used-to-be friend told me, you might need to get out of town for a couple of weeks. What? This is me. This is Jan. Are you kidding me? She wasn't kidding. Long story short, this is a miracle. This is God in my life. What happened was my brother's an attorney who is a teetotaler. He is not one of us, but he does have the family disease, trust me. He got me a really good defense attorney up here, and it ended up that I did not have, the charge was reduced. See, I don't even remember because I was drinking, and I don't remember exactly what happened, and I never told him thank you, but the bottom line is I did not get charged with a felony. I got charged with a a misdemeanor charge of assaulting a police officer because I cussed him out because I was mad because he made my friend cry. They don't look too kindly on that. And I don't blame him. He should not have been treated that way. Dang. What an ass I was. But anyway, so I'm going to move on. I got hung up in that. I told Scott not to let me do that because I get off on these tangents, and there I go. So anyway, never again, I get out. And when my roommate picked me up from the county jail, I said, God, let's stop and get a 12 case of beer. You know, I got to have a beer. I got to have a drink, because that's what I did when I felt bad like that. It's just, you know, not, God, I almost did it this time. I need to stop drinking. No. So, you know, I move on and keep drinking like that, and always around people that drank like that. And I met my husband in a bar, and I hadn't dated men in 2 years because they just were too much trouble, and I just didn't want to ever be in a relationship. My husband walks in the bar, and I said, I like that guy. And I picked him up in a bar. And he really didn't know what hit him. because when I make up my mind, I make up my mind. Well, we dated for about 6 months, and then we quit dating because I was ready for a relationship and he was not. Long story short, 6 months later, when I got past my nursing boards, I called him up and just to talk and said, "Hey, why don't we go out to dinner?" And we've been together ever since. And that was, I never can remember how many years. We got married in 1984. You do the math. So he drank. I thought he drank just like I did. I mean, I didn't say, "Do you black out every time you drink?" Because I just figured everybody did. If you drank that much, because, you know, we would one for one it. I mean, I was like, "You're not getting ahead of me." But I did black out. And then I got it in my head, well, if we get married, I'm going to feel better. And when I met him, I said, "I don't want to ever get married, and I don't want to ever have children." He was like, "Soulmate." Well, I changed my mind. And then I did want to get married. We get married, and then I'm thinking, you know, all my nurse friends, we commiserate. I was the first one to get married, and so I started thinking, I think a baby would make me feel better. Now, we didn't talk about that, but I got pregnant. And you know what? That didn't help a bit. As a matter of fact, that made things worse, way worse. So for me, I just kept drinking like that, and we went through periods of times where, you know, nobody's told you, marriage is real hard work. Really hard work. Nobody ever told me that. I thought if you married somebody and you didn't like them, you just got a divorce. I mean, that's what we did in my family, you know? And that's actually what my mother told me. I mean, she was like, "Yeah, Jan, I mean, you know, if it doesn't work out, you can always get a divorce." But my husband said, "No, we're going to work on this. We love each other." And we did. We're going to work on this. And thank God sent him to me, because if it weren't for my husband, I honestly don't believe I'd be standing here. I know I wouldn't be sober, and I'm just not so sure I'd be alive the way I was drinking. So, yeah, that didn't work. The child didn't work. And I told you kind of how I kind of ended up in here by going to my doctor and saying, after that last drunk, passing out in my car in the driveway, at least I made it to the driveway, and I went to my doctor, and she sent me to see this guy, this psychiatrist over the addiction recovery program, and I go in there thinking, okay. And he says, okay. I talked to him for about 2 hours, and I said, "Oh, I got to go now. I got somebody covering for me. And I've been here longer than I thought I was going to." And I turned around to walk out, and he said, "You need to sit back down." And he said, hands me the phone, said, "You're going to call and report yourself to the Board of Nursing." Oh, no. No, you don't understand. My mom, who has dementia, lives with us, and I cannot leave my husband alone with her. And he said, "Do you want to call, or do you want me to? Because if you call, it looks a lot better." I did. She told me what to say. I went into treatment. And I believed I had a moral problem. All of you guys were alcoholics, but I was morally a bad person. I was just bad. And but I did go to treatment, and I took the first step that first morning after I woke up after that last drunk, and I sat up on the side of the bed and said, "God, please help me. I'm an alcoholic." That I never called myself an alcoholic. That wasn't me doing that. And when I ended up in treatment and I got out and I got my first sponsor, but that was my first step. And she told me, "You need to meet me every Saturday morning at this group, Metro Big Book in Birmingham, every Saturday morning at 8:30. And you better be in jail, on a ventilator, or something horrible if you don't show up. I expect to see you there." And I did. And that's still that. That wasn't my home group, but that's still my home group now, and it is my anchor. It is some hardcore big book sobriety, and those people saved me, well, along with God. So for me, I got sober and I was angry. I was mad at everybody. I was mad at every single one of you. And my poor husband, he didn't know why I was mad at him, but I was mad at him too. My best friend, alcohol, was gone, and it couldn't come back. Ever. That's what I kept thinking. Ever. And my sponsor said, one day at a time. You don't think about the future. You just think about today and trying to stay sober today. So I did. And when I was 6 months sober, she told me I needed to get into service work in my home group. And so I don't even remember what the first position was, but I had every position in that home group. And then it was like, well, okay, I'm going to get involved in district. And when I became GSR of that home group, then I went to district meetings. And from district, I went to area assembly. And area assembly, this is the first time since that 6 month sober date that I have not held a service position. And I have a 17-month-old grandson, so that's my service position right this second. I still sponsor women. The four sponsees I've got now, they've been with me a very long time, really five, but she's like 14 years, and she kind of sponsors me sometimes. They help keep me sober. You know, I have been, and being in the middle of AA, because I was so pissed and I was so antsy, that's service work is what helped keep me sober and keep me grounded. And having a sponsor who taught me that. And I try and teach the women I work with. Some of them it sticks, some of them it doesn't, but I never keep trying. And through that experience, I began to see what life could be like. You know, I would say, I'm bored. I don't know what to do. I'm bored. And she said, no, that's called peace. You're not bored. You're just having little snippets of peace. And I thought, so I'm not bored. Okay. And, but I'm going to tell you, I mean, I have waxed and waned and all through my sobriety. And, and I know I'm getting away from God. What's wrong with me? When I'm getting away from God and I'm irritable and I'm snappish and nothing's right, I know what I need to do. I know what I need to do. I need to ramp up my program. I need to call my sponsor. She'll have me all the time when she sees me getting that way. You call me every day until I tell you not to. And I do, because I know she knows, and I want to have what she has. I hope I have it as long as she does, but I have what I have right now, and 16 and a half years ain't too bad, because this is so much better. I don't want to drink again. I don't want to live that life. I don't want to be morally and spiritually bankrupt again. So for me, you know, working the steps, being around women who work this program, trying to practice these principles in all my affairs, like at work, I think everybody should work the 12 steps. I think everybody on the face of the earth should work the 12 steps, and it would be so much better. But you know what? There are people who actually are like what we have to learn to be. They're just like that. That just freaks me out. There are people that are just like that normally. Wow, that's so awesome. And I work with a couple of those, they're sprinkled in, and they always just cease to amaze me. They just think that way. That's the way they think. Wow, that is so cool. They don't have to have a program. They're just that way. But one thing I do want to mention before I finish up is the first father, my biological father, He was at our wedding, and he crashed all these other wedding parties before we even got to where the reception was. And we were not close. We were estranged, but we really got estranged after that. But at any rate, I hadn't spoken to him in years. I don't even know how many years. And I stayed home, and my husband went to Al-Anon. And at the time, the AA and Al-Anon in Montgomery Area Assembly, it was at the same time, at the same place. And this white-haired guy with a ponytail goes up to the mic and says, my name is Dale Stone. And he popped up and he looked at him and he said he doesn't remember anything anybody else said. He was just staring at him the whole time. And I can't remember exactly what transpired, but I know Scott went up to him and spoke to him. And when he came home and told me that on Sunday afternoon, I was like, he got sober. Are you kidding me? That man got sober? And then it was like, wait a minute. He never made amends to me. I should have been the first person on his amends list. That asshole. And then I was really pissed off at him. And so the next area assembly, I mean, I should have gone to that one. For some reason, I didn't because I was GSR. The next area assembly, he was there. And I stared at him. And so the Friday night speaker, we went to that. And afterwards, I mean, I made a beeline. You know, I'm going up there. And he's standing around talking to some other old timers. And they're just, you know, shooting a crap. And hey, you know, there's about three other guys with him. And I go up and, and he just kind of, he said, hey. And I go, he said, hey, how are you doing? And I said, good, how are you? And he said, good. And I said, you don't have any idea who I am, do you? And he said, yeah, you're, and I said, Jan. I'm Jan. Well, his, years ago, a partner in business of his had a daughter named Jan, and she was my age, and he said, how is your dad doing? Is he still selling insurance? And I just looked at him, and he went, I said, your daughter, Jan. And he said, he just kind of looked down a minute, and he said, well, some things never change. I may be sober, but I'm still an asshole. I said, you certainly are. But I always wanted a daddy. I always wanted a daddy. And I never had one. So I thought, here's my chance. Wrong. Here's my chance. So every time, I mean, I stalked him at area assembly. And I would say, hey, can I come down to your house and go to your home group? And no, I don't have the second bedroom set up. Okay. Next time, hey, can I come down to your house and stay with you for the weekend? I'll sleep on the couch. He said, well, I don't have a couch. I have two love seats. Oh, okay. And I asked him a third time. I don't even remember what he said, but my sponsor said, stop it. You are groveling. He doesn't want you to come there. Did that ever cross your mind? Don't you think he would have contacted you if he would have wanted to? And I didn't like that. And she said, you can't have, he's not going to be a daddy to you. He doesn't want to. He has shown you over and over again. Or maybe his sponsor told him, stay out of her life. You've done enough damage. Leave her alone. I don't know. All I know is, so I had to be content with an AA buddy that I had lunch with at area assembly, and he ended up dying of a blood disease. It's like the precursor to leukemia. And my sponsor told me I owed him an amends too. And my amends to him was holding on to that resentment for my entire adult life. Because she told me if I didn't get rid of that, I was going to drink again. And I said, no way. I didn't do anything wrong. But I found out through working with her, that my part in it was I wouldn't let go of that resentment. I was still trying to be the victim. I can't be the victim. I don't have that luxury. And but you know what? When he died, I felt like I did the best I could. And I also realized he did the best he could. And after my mom died, and she died of advanced Alzheimer's in a nursing home, and I resented, I mean, I was sober, and it just ate my lunch. And I finally realized that the only thing I could do was, like it says, I could treat the sick person as you would cheerfully treat a sick friend. So she couldn't really be mom. She wasn't mom anymore. But yeah, when that breath left her, so did my resentment. I was at her bedside, and that resentment left. That's how long it took, and I've been sober a while. So I thank God for the opportunity because I know they did the best they could, both my mom and my dad. Maybe it wasn't enough for me, but you know what? They did the best they could. My daughter, we have a daughter, and she grew up with a drunk mother, you know? Daddy, why does mommy do that? Still in bed. I could hear them in the driveway going somewhere. Why does she do that? And he said, well, honey, your mom's under a lot of stress. Poor him. You know, your mom's a drunk. And I should have seen it. Her friends didn't come over. She didn't bring her friends over. Why would they? I mean, I was going to be sitting around drunk on wine, and I made promises I didn't keep, and I still see that little face like, no, honey, we'll do it next weekend. And we didn't. So she has suffered from this disease. She is not in my group. She is not an alcoholic, but she doesn't see the damage that I did to her, but boy, do I. And the damage I did to my husband, and the damage I've done to everybody around me, because I've hurt so many people, and it has taken me some years to realize how much pain and chaos I caused. But I don't have to live with that guilt anymore, that guilt and that shame. I've given it up to my higher power, and I am so grateful for this program. I mean, I get to know you people. I feel like I know every one of you, and I don't know every one of you, but when I walk into a meeting, I'm instantly at home. It's kind of like, I'm with my people. And yeah, AA is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I just had a very good friend who came in when I did, who is also a nurse, who relapsed. And it broke my heart. But I know why. She did the same thing everybody else does. But she went to treatment. Well, she was forced to treatment. She was intervened on at work. And all I can do is pray for her, and I told her that. I love you, and I'm glad you're back, and I'm going to pray for you every single day. And because she worked this program. That just goes to show you, if I don't stay hypervigilant, it can go away like that. And it'll be my fault. So, obviously, that did not, I tell Scott, it never goes like I want it to. I don't ever say what I want it to. But I ask God to bring forth the words from my mouth, whatever he thinks that I need to say. So, that's what happened. I want to close with this in the big book. And it's at the last page of A Vision for You. And this is my favorite thing in the whole big book. And I thought it was a bunch of hullabaloo until I've lived it now. I've lived it and I know it's true. It's the very last paragraph, and it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you for letting me share with you.